again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
Welcome to today's rally on, unfortunately, yet another disgusting anniversary for the United States.
Coming up, we'll join with Chicago peace activists who rallied in March for peace on the 9th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq.
What was initially envisioned as a way to oppose the Soviet Union and the ground invasion became a way to wage war on the left domestically in those countries, in those NATO countries.
And we'll hear a short and irreverent history of the G8 and NATO as Chicago prepares for the NATO summit scheduled in May. But first, here's some headlines from the Indy Media Network in Chicago and around the world with Mitchell Stupinchik.
Kenya Indy Media reported the death of a longtime Kenyan radio journalist, media activist, organizer, and Indy Media contributor. On February 21, 2012, Stephen Niash was shot dead in the Korogocho ghetto of Nairobi, Kenya, where he had lived and worked for most of his life. At the time of the feature, the motive and details of his killing was not clear. Niash was one of the founders of KOCH-FM, a community radio station and partner of Kenya Indy Media, which worked to empower residents of the Korogocho ghetto. He was also a noted organizer, working on conferences and campaigns in media activism and environmental issues. Niash is survived by his wife, mother, and two children. Kenya Indy Media is working with Niash's family to establish a fund to pay for burial expenses and family needs. Niash is the third Indy Media contributor known to be killed while in Indy Media service, after Lenin Call Najera of Indy Media Guayaquil in Ecuador, who was killed by government agents in 2004, and Chicago-born Brad Will of New York City Indy Media, who was killed by Mexican paramilitaries in 2006 while documenting community struggles in Oaxaca, Mexico. Philadelphia Indy Media reported on efforts to end the solitary confinement torture of a man jailed for nearly 40 years. Quoting from the feature dated February 19th, Russell Maroon Shoatz, a 68-year-old prisoner held at the State Correctional Institution Green in southwestern Pennsylvania, has been kept in solitary confinement for more than 21 years. The Human Rights Coalition, along with the Center for Constitutional Rights and the National Lawyers Guild, is calling on supporters to join in the petition to have him released from these torturous conditions. Shoatz has been unable to hold his children or grandchildren or interact with others in a humane setting during this time, despite not having violated prison rules in 2 decades. He has suffered severe psychological anguish, and his physical health has been worsened by the stress of prolonged isolation. Shoatz has spent nearly 40 years within the Pennsylvania prison system, 30 of those in solitary confinement. Prison officials claim that Shoatz is a security threat due to past escapes and attempts, though new evidence has surfaced that his continued solitary confinement is based on secret and fraudulent evidence of a non-existent plan to take over a prison in the 1980s. Prison officials also identified his political associations as a basis for continuing to torture him via solitary confinement. DC Indy Media reports on successful efforts to help a Washington, D.C. homeowner fend off an unjust foreclosure attempt. On February 27th, Bertina Jones, supported by Occupy Our Homes and by other activists, staged a protest outside the D.C. offices of Freddie Mac and forced a building lockdown which activists were able to break. Jones was then able to enter the building and force a meeting with both Freddie Mac and with Bank of America, who agreed not to evict her pending a review of her case. Jones objected to a planned and probably illegal foreclosure of her home, despite her ability and willingness to, as the feature reported, do what they told her to do. Jones sought help from Occupy activists after the lawyer she planned to recruit demanded $20,000 in fees just to take up her case, and she got no cooperation from Freddie Mac or Bank of America regarding the terms of her loan. Indy Bay posted a feature on March 20, 2012, headlined Indy Bay Journalists Charged with Felony, Conspiracy to Make Media. Quoting from the feature, Santa Cruz County District Attorney Bob Lee has embarked on a full frontal assault against independent media in Santa Cruz by including 4 regular contributors to the independent news website IndyBay.org among the 11 people charged with multiple felonies and misdemeanors after the occupation of a vacant bank building on November 30, 2011. The National Press Photographers Association and the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press wrote a letter brief addressed to the court seeking dismissal of charges. In a related joint press release, the two groups wrote, "This is just the most recent case where journalists have been interfered with and arrested while covering Occupy Wall Street protests throughout the country. In almost every case, those charges, ranging from disorderly conduct and obstruction of governmental administration to trespass, have been dismissed or the defendant journalists have been acquitted." Chicago Indie Media highlighted a number of Chicago-area wins and struggles with a feature headlined, "G8 Move from Chicago Marks Month Full of Activist Achievements Victories." On March 5th, the G8 gathering of major world governments announced an abrupt shift of the locale of their 2012 summit from Chicago to Camp David, Maryland. Some activists took credit for forcing the move and announced no slowdown in efforts against the 2012 summit of NATO still slated for Chicago in May. On February 29th, Midwest Generation announced that it will shut down its Fisk and Crawford coal-powered power plants by 2014, a win for local environmental activists who worked for years highlighting the health and environmental problems attributed to the plants. Also, workers at Sirius Materials, the same Goose Island factory which saw a six-day worker sit-in in 2008 when it was known as Republic Windows and Doors, staged another sit-in on February 23rd, citing insufficient worker input over the direction of the plant. After only 12 hours, management at Sirius Materials gave in and agreed to a 90-day reprieve. And students at both DePaul University and at Piccolo Elementary School staged their own occupations over concerns of tuition raises, in the case of DePaul, and concerns over planned privatization efforts, in the case of Piccolo.
Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches. Iraq is officially at an end, and the surge in Afghanistan is slated to end later this year. So one might think that there's less of a motivation for protesting in the United States for international peace. But a closer look tells a different story. There are regular U.S. drone attacks in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, killing thousands of innocent people. There are threats of war against Iran. And currently, the war in Iraq is subcontracted out to private firms. Arms are sold to Gulf dictatorships, and as usual, there is an overall prioritization towards war and profiting of war regardless who is in office. For these reasons, peace activists in Chicago took to the streets again, marching in Chicago's South Asian neighborhood on the afternoon of Sunday, March 18, 2012, near the 9th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. We'll now hear audio from a rally at the corner of Devon and Hoyne on Chicago's north side. Andy Thayer, a Chicago peace activist, is the rally's moderator.
My name is Andy Thayer. I'm with the Midwest Anti-War Mobilization. Welcome to today's rally on, unfortunately, yet another disgusting anniversary for the United States, the 9th anniversary of the U.S. war on Iraq. The war that our president tells us is over, even though his Pentagon just a few weeks ago asked for $3 billion more dollars for this supposedly ended war. And our president has not only continued that war in different form in Iraq, but of course, he's dramatically escalated the war in Afghanistan. Each year, last year was the year of the greatest number of civilian casualties in the now 10-year plus war in Afghanistan, the war which is the longest war in United States history. And of course, our particular focus in bringing the demonstration here to the Devon Avenue neighborhood is, of course, the continuing attacks on the people of Pakistan, the drone attacks, which during each year of President Obama's administration have not only increased in number, but have increased dramatically in casualties. And we're very proud to say that we are going to be having at the other end of our rally today, we're going to be having live direct comments from Pakistan via Skype. Yes, we've actually managed to master the technology, we believe. And so I think it's going to be a rare privilege, because we're going to be talking directly with the people who are organizing against the attacks on the Pakistani people from within Pakistan, who are organizing against the drone attacks financed and sent over by our government. But before we do that, we're going to have a few brief speakers, because there's many issues besides Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq that we need to talk about today. We need to talk about the continuing dispossession of the Palestinian people, the continuing encroachment upon their lands. We need to talk about the threat of a new war on Iran, using many of the same lies that were used to sell the Iraq War, whose anniversary we're unfortunately memorializing today. So I'd like to ask our speakers to come up to the microphone right now. Don't be bashful. Jill, come on.
Hi, my name is Jill McLaughlin. I'm with World Can't Wait Chicago chapter. And I wanted to talk briefly today about coming out against the threats against Iran and Syria. We all know that what the Syrian government and what the Iranian government are doing to their people is wrong. We all know that, we all agree. But those people have a right to self-determination and a right to determine what's going to happen for themselves without interference from the U.S. government. Interference only means domination. It doesn't mean liberation for those people. Another thing about these threats against Iran, whether they're coming from the U.S. or from Israel, it's not a simple matter of just going in and taking over. When Obama and Clinton said all options are on the table, that meant nuclear weapons, nuclear buster bunkers, which would be totally devastating, not just to the people of Iran, but to the countries around them. Can the people of this world really afford another war, another ongoing of this so-called war on terror? No, we cannot. We have to stand up against these threats against Syria and Iran. We have to say no war on Iran, no war on Syria, The world can't wait.
Thank you. Let's give it up for Jill. Next, we're going to have Neil Reznikoff talking about Afghanistan. And I should note that when the G8 comes to Chicago this May, they're probably going to be proclaiming some sort of plan to end the war in Afghanistan. Now, after 10 years of lies about Afghanistan and 10 years, almost 10 years of lies about Iraq, are we going to believe President Obama when he says he's going to be ending the war in Afghanistan?
No!
Okay, here's Neil to tell us a little bit more about all that.
To segue from the last speaker, opposing the U.S. threats of war on Iran and Syria, I want you to know that the Midwest anti-war mobilization has initiated opposition, building up opposition to the U.S. war on Iran and Syria, and building an emergency response in case the U.S. or its proxies such as Israel actually militarily attack Iran or Syria. If you would like to be on that emergency response network, I have a clipboard here for you to sign up on, and some leaflets, and some other people do too. This is a culmination of a whole series of the U.S. building up its empire illegally and unjustly. There's a basic law that one country has no right to invade or attack another country unless it's been attacked first. The government of Afghanistan did not attack the U.S. It did not threaten the U.S. Nevertheless, the U.S. went in, even though the government of Afghanistan said if the U.S. thinks that bin Laden did it, they would, and presented evidence, they would turn bin Laden over to an international tribunal. The U.S. refused and instead went in to bomb Afghanistan with all kinds of weaponry, including depleted uranium weaponry, and has been doing that for 10 years. And the U.S. then went into Iraq and Libya and is now threatening Iran and Syria. We need to oppose all this, including the threats of attack on Pakistan and the drone attacks on Pakistan, killing many, many innocent civilians. That's the reason for the rally today, and let's keep it up and build up our opposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil. And now I'm very honored to introduce Mr. Saeed Khan, Dr. Saeed Khan. Dr. Khan has been a leader here in the Pakistani community of Chicago. He is principally responsible for the organizing of today's rally. Let's give a big hand for Mr. Khan.
Thank you very much. I'll be brief because after March I'll speak something in detail, but now I'll speak about the two issues which are very important. My friend has already spoken about the drone attacks. For the last many, many years, Pakistan is under drone attacks. So far, more than 300 drone attacks have taken place, and more than 3,000 people have been killed, innocent people. And they say that we are going to kill the terrorists. I don't understand that the drone from 20,000 above, how can they recognize who is a terrorist and who is not the terrorist and innocent, the innocent? So the question is, how the American go there killing innocent people? Number one, they are responsible for this criminal act, and number two, they are are violating the sovereignty of a sovereign nation. I understand the Pakistan government, which is always, as every successive government, is a client agent of the United States, and they support them. But as far as the people of Pakistan are concerned, they condemn it. This is one thing. The other thing, that the military agency in Pakistan abduct the people, and they just, through torture, they kill them, and they throw on the street. And there's no accountability for that, the military agency. So far, more according to information, more than 10,000 people have been kidnapped. They have never been, if they have committed any crime, according to them, so they should be produced before the court. This is an extrajudicial killing, which is unwarranted and unacceptable. The other thing is, there's another issue. Pakistan have there are multi-nationalities in Pakistan. One nation is Balochistan. In Balochistan, they have been taking a military operation for the last 64 years. Every regime come and they take on them, military operation. And more than 6,000-7,000 people have been kidnapped from there, and the same they do with them. They kill them to torture, throw their body. Balochistan happened to be the richest province of the country, but they are the poorest because they have all the minerals and everything, but they are denied, and they have become practically a colonial province. So we condemn all this, but we will speak in Western and Diwan, and parking a lot of the Diwan Bank. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Khan. Now, we're very honored to have Wade Hannon from the War Resisters League, who's going to be talking about the issue that we're memorializing today here, frankly, the 9th anniversary of the continuing war on the Iraqi people. Let's give a hand for Wade here.
Thank you. The U.S. government has, in the war against Iraq and Iran, the second longest wars in U.S. history, the first longest being the war against indigenous people from when the Europeans first invaded what is now the United States. But it's ridiculous that we allow our government to continue to waste billions and billions of dollars every year to brutalize and subjugate the people of Iraq. And it's time to stop this. It's time to hold the administration's feet to the fire. And even though they are just politicians, we still have to hold them accountable. So I would hope that you all will continue to come out and to show your opposition and to keep the faith. Thank you.
Thank you, Wade. As we know, there's been a tremendous cost for these wars, not just in terms of the human lives of the Afghanis, the Pakistanis, the Iraqis, the Somalis, the Yemenis, and the list goes on. It's also been a huge price that American working people have paid in this country. We live in the only country in the world, it's an advanced industrial nation, that does not have free access to health care. We live in one of the only countries that doesn't have low-cost or no-cost higher education that's amongst the industrialized countries. We've got lousy public transportation. We live in a city who's seen half its mental health clinics closed within the past few months. The list goes on and on. And then, of course, there's the foreclosure crisis. Okay? And we've seen the banks get bailed out over and over again, but we're not seeing homeowners being bailed out. And to give us some information about that, we're happy to have Megan and Ramon from Communities United Against Foreclosure and Eviction up here in Rogers Park. They're going to say a few words about the attacks on our communities right here at home.
Yay! Hi, good afternoon. We're the Rogers Park chapter of Communities United Against Foreclosure and Eviction, and we're here to stand in solidarity with the people around the world getting attacked, and also want to bring it home to a different kind of war that's happening here in our own neighborhood. How many people here are from Rogers Park? Okay, and how many people here know someone who's going through foreclosure or the eviction process? Okay, take a look around. That's a lot of hands. I'm gonna let Ramon talk about the resources we share. Please come and talk to us afterwards if you know you or someone you know would benefit from our resources.
So this is Ramon from Communities United Against Eviction and Foreclosure. This not only affects us, it affects soldiers' families who don't get the benefits. They don't get the benefits like your soldier's cousin or whatever. You know, they don't get that benefit. And so, you know, it affects not only us, but the soldiers. So we're the United, so we want to see the tyranny of the banks and the foreclosures and the banks not helping out people, giving people the red tape, run around with a lot of paperwork, and we're here trying to really work with the banks and trying to find resolution. And the banks don't hardly work with us, yet they bail out the banks, but they can't bail us out. We're trying to even make a referendum that we can make for the city council to make a 1% fund from the banks to pay the fund and give it to appropriate to the citizens, for they could help pay their homes or foreclosure problems or rent and all that. We're trying to find any appropriation, any funding whatsoever. We've been working on it, and we know there's a lot of tactics and a lot of research stuff we got. We meet up for the whole communities. We have meetings, and if anybody's on Wednesdays, if anybody's interested, come in a meeting, which is fully packed. We got free resources. We give you free information. We got a lawyer who talks. We make videos for the people who are in foreclosures for their homes, and we'll go to help with the court dates and all that, and get you connected with the resources that you need. And people. Just believe it. There's more that you could do. You really got to stand up, because if you don't stand up and get the help, you know what? That home that you thought that you lost, guess what? You could still have and be in that apartment, in that home, period. So please join us in one of our community group meetings every Wednesday, Rogers Park, 7460. First and third Wednesday, as for Megan says, she's the leader here. First and third Wednesday at 7463 North Ridge, and we'll give you tons of information. You'll see people, lawyers, and other people help in this subject. It's not only for us; it helps with the veterans' families and for a safer and safer and strong community. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Ramon and Megan from Communities United Against Foreclosure and Eviction. Now we have faced an ongoing civil liberties battle in this country. It's hard to believe that things could have gotten any worse than under the administration of George W. Bush and the Patriot Act, but indeed they have gotten worse. We're not only trying to fight to restore rights won in the 20th century, the 19th century, and the 18th century, we're now left in the position, as pathetic as it is trying to restore rights that were won in the 17th century. For students of history, I'm talking about habeas corpus and the Magna Carta. The whole notion that the government can't just arbitrarily take you and detain you indefinitely has now been allowed into law under the alleged constitutional law scholar from the University of Chicago, none other than President Obama. It's a crying shame. And if any of you are alumni of the University of Chicago, I think you need your money back. Your diploma isn't worth as much as you might have thought. But someone who has a great deal of expertise to talk about this is none other than our Bob Clark from the Committee to Defend the Bill of Rights. Bob, tell us what's going on here.
Thanks, Andy. By the way, Magna Carta is the 13th century, so it's even more scandalous. Anyway, Obama drones on while the Bill of Rights burns. That's the problem. The justification for increasing war in Afghanistan and Iran and Yemen and Somalia, you name it, Uganda, Australia, it's always the claim that we are engaged in an unending war, the so-called war against terror, whether the official language is that or not, an unending war that encompasses the whole world. Drawing from that premise, our civil liberties come in second. And this government, a continuum, as Andy suggested, from Bush through Obama, has jettisoned fundamental rights of assembly, due process, and so on. We're coming up against this in the plans for the protest against NATO on May 20th and on the days around that in Chicago with permit issues and other issues threatening our right to legitimate assembly. At the extreme of this, we have had the appearance of the Attorney General in Chicago at Northwestern Law School just a few days ago claiming that the President of the United States has the right to authorize the execution without trial of American citizens anywhere in the world. That's about as far as it goes. That goes beyond torture. People were worked up about the torture issue under Bush. Now we have presidential kill orders openly, quote, justified by the claim that the constitutional guarantee of due process doesn't mean, as our Attorney General said, judicial due process. You can have your due process in the secrecy of CIA meetings on drone attacks on 16-year-old boys in Yemen, and that's your damn due process, and be satisfied with it because we're defending you in the war on terror. We have, as Andy alluded to, the National Defense Authorization Act, which a lot of people are working to expose, scandalously passed by Congress, codifying the Bushian claims first visited on Jose Padilla right here in Chicago, that anybody anywhere, U.S. citizen or not, can be declared an enemy combatant, swept off into military tribunals, indefinite confinement, no defense, no process, no representation. This is part of what we're fighting for. The struggle against these wars is exactly part and parcel of the struggle for civil liberties.
You've been hearing audio from A Rally for Peace on Chicago's North Side, recorded on March 18, 2012. To learn more, please go online to chicagomassaction.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Hey, yo, people, this is outrageous from Rancho. We got a question for GA. Why do they want us up, man? Let's go, listen to the question, man. Okay.
We got a question for you, G8, we got a question for you. Why do you want us to suffer? Why do you want us to perish? You're young, yet you know we are the creditors. Yet you know that we are the creditors. Castle debts, castle debts. You the G8, castle debts, castle debts. You the G8. We got a question for you, G8. Why do you-
got a question for you. Why do you want us to suffer? Why do you want us to perish? Sure, you're getting on. We are the creditors. Yet you know that we are the creditors. Consultants, consultants, you the GA. Consultants, consultants, you the GA.
The North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the G8 group of eight major world governments have drawn a lot of attention in the Chicago corporate media after both groups announced that they would hold their summits together in Chicago in May 2012. But both groups have drawn increasing public and critical scrutiny, and the G8 have regularly drawn major international street protests since the first major such protest in Germany in 1999. Moreover, the Occupy Wall Street movement emerged after the summit was announced, and there is a rich history of Chicago actions in the annals of American protest. Plus, it's relatively easy to travel to Chicago. All of these factors could make for considerable international protest in Chicago against the NATO and G8. And these factors may have played a role in the abrupt announcement in early March by the G8 to move the G8 summit from Chicago to Camp David, Maryland. But NATO is still coming to Chicago in May, and protesters have vowed to continue organizing for what could be major protests. To learn more about the groups that have sparked all this attention and action, we'll hear a presentation from Chicago political activist and writer Eric Reuter, who spoke about NATO and G8 in a presentation entitled A Short and Irreverent History of the G8 and NATO. This presentation was recorded on January 21, 2012, before the G8 announced their move to Camp David.
The reason for an irreverent, the need for an irreverent history, is that any good history of these institutions means going beyond how they describe themselves. It means rejecting their own self-justifications and the justification of their defenders, which are, you know, chiefly the global 1%, to be honest. So the dictionary definition of irreverent, that is showing a lack of respect for people or things that are generally taken seriously, is thus required, really. It's kind of called for in this case to be effective in coming to real understanding of what NATO and G8 are, why they should be resisted, why they're coming to Chicago in May, and so on. So let's start with NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The treaty itself was established in 1949, and it states that NATO members, quote, are determined to safeguard the freedom, common heritage, and civilization of their peoples, founded on the principles of democracy, individual liberty, and the rule of law. They seek to promote stability and well-being in the North Atlantic area. They are resolved to unite their efforts to collective defense and for the preservation of peace and security. Okay, peace, democracy, security, all noble principles. In practice, of course, NATO has trampled on all of these principles, breaking both the spirit and the letter of its own bylaws on many occasions. Back around the time of its founding, NATO's first Secretary General, an aristocrat, of course, Lord Ismay, was overcome by a fit of honesty when he described the real purpose of NATO with these words. NATO was to, quote, keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. In other words, the U.S. wanted to draw together all the various allies emerging out of the Second World War under a security umbrella, to prepare for a standoff with the Soviet Union, which became, you know, the Cold War, but of course also to provide within NATO some sort of counterbalance to Germany, which after the Second World War was considered to be the sort of the economic powers of Europe that needed to be kind of kept in its place, lest there be a replay of the Second World War. But the Cold War was really only barely cold. It threatened to turn hot on multiple occasions. The reasons for that are many, but one of them is the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, something that if you lived sort of post the Cold War, you may not have ever heard of, but it's known appropriately by its acronym of MAD, mutually assured destruction. And it was MAD because it drove the world toward a massive arms buildup. The basic idea is that so long as I've got a first strike nuclear weapon, so long as I think that you can retaliate against me if I use it, then we won't start a nuclear war because we'll be mutually assured that we'll destroy one another. So part of being able to assure the other's destruction is that you have to build up a massive stockpile of nuclear weapons anyway. And so basically that impelled the world along a huge arms race that led ultimately to a stockpile of nuclear weapons that could destroy the world many times over. But, again, at least the first strike nuclear weapon could be retaliated against, and therefore we'd all be dead, and wouldn't that be the best outcome? That's mad. So this brought the world, really, this doctrine, brought the world to the brink on several occasions of actually a hot war. There was the Cuban Missile Crisis being the most famous, and then, of course, the constant anxiety that some rogue general might take matters into his own hands and start a war. Dr. Strangelove, people may be familiar with. So there was the way in which NATO functioned during the Cold War, in which it never fired a shot, but was essentially coordinating the U.S. sort of projection, the projection of U.S. power into all of Western Europe, and deploying and redeploying nuclear weaponry all over that area in order to kind of create this mutual assured destruction scenario. Okay, so that's kind of covers the military side of NATO up from, you know, the end of the Second World War till the end of the Cold War. And I'm going to come back to some of the military stuff since then. But what about the other side? What about NATO's commitment to democracy? And I think there's a really interesting book, if you want to do some more reading about this, called NATO's Secret Armies by Daniel Ganser. It came out several years ago, 5-6 years ago. And basically, the thesis of the book goes through some pretty amazing revelations, actually, that came at the end of the Cold War, of what were called the NATO's stay-behind armies, or secret armies. And again, these were armies that were prepared for the Cold War turning hot, and they were meant to be in place to resist a Soviet ground invasion of Western Europe. And they were set up by U.S. and U.K. spy agencies like MI6 and CIA. And this is a quote from the introduction of the book. The notion of the project in the intelligence services undoubtedly began as an effort to create forces that would remain quiescent until war brought them into play. But instead, in country after country, we find the same groups of individuals, or cells, originally activated for the wartime function, beginning to exercise their strength in peacetime political processes. Sometimes these efforts involve violence, even terrorism, and sometimes the terrorists made use of the very equipment furnished them for their Cold War function. Essentially, what happened was networks of spies that were setting up groups on the ground that could defend from a Soviet invasion, they made alliances with various right-wing forces, domestic political forces. And what was initially envisioned as a way to oppose the Soviet Union and a ground invasion became a way to wage war on the left domestically in those countries, in those NATO countries throughout Western Europe. Of course, this was a time in which there were large communist parties that had a lot of electoral influence, and so there was this sort of way in which NATO also then came to intervene in and undermine the very democracy that it was supposedly set up to protect and that its principles supposedly enshrined. So now let's look at the end of the Cold War. According to its own self-defense mandate, you know, that it was really just meant to enable the Western European countries of the United States to defend one another in the event that any of them was attacked, NATO should have been disbanded with the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, the main sort of other pole in the Cold War was gone, but instead the U.S. and other Western European powers sought to enlarge NATO, bringing in new countries, kind of encroaching and beginning trying to encircle Russia further after 1991, and you know, drawing in various countries of the formerly Eastern Bloc. Now today, NATO countries collectively account for more than 70% of all of the world's military spending. So, and the U.S. has nearly half of the world's military spending. So then it kind of begs the question, well, then who is NATO exactly defending themselves from if they are kind of almost all of world military spending? But that's really exactly the point, that since that time, they've basically engaged upon a series of, quote, tests of NATO's military operations. First started with Kosovo, sort of on the edge, on the doorstep of Western Europe in the Balkans, and with quote, peacekeeping there, although some of the biggest episodes of ethnic cleansing in that war, the war in Yugoslavia that began in 1999, took place after the NATO intervention began, and with its essentially turning a blind eye to it. But then, you know, the U.S. has gone on. I mean, you've gotten the NATO being the force in Afghanistan, even though it's largely the United States, but it's done under the aegis of NATO. And then, of course, NATO's intervention in Libya. And I want to try to come back to these here in a moment. I want to first say a few words about the G8, where am I at time-wise, and then a few kind of thoughts about what it means to oppose them and what they represent kind of more generally as in terms of the system, the economic system, political system, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, all right, so I want to turn to the G8 now. The G8 countries, which are the U.S., Britain, Germany, France, Japan, Italy, Russia, and Canada. You might wonder why Canada is counted as sort of one of the world's, and this is nothing against Canadians or Canada, but its economy is just a tiny fraction of really the rest of these countries. And the truth is that it was the United States that insisted that Canada be included in the 70s because they wanted what they considered to be a kind of unshakable ally in the context of the G8. So anyway, Canada is part of the G8. The G8 countries contain 15% of the world's population as a whole, but account for more than 60% of world economic output. They are at the top of the global capitalist food chain, I guess you'd say, and their leaders are meeting and meet regularly to make sure that they stay that way. And that means, even if it means trouncing, you know, climate change concerns or workers and workers' rights and so on, that's really been they've never considered that an obstacle. Though it's been something they paid lip service to, they have to. I want to say something about that again later too. But the group of powerful countries that became the G8 got its start in 1975 in the context of a world oil crisis and global recession. And since then, the G8 heads of state meet annually. They are all committed to neoliberalism, which basically is, have people heard that term before? Or who hasn't heard the term neoliberalism before? All right, well, I will define it. The basic idea of neoliberalism is that let the market run everything. Let the market be as free and unfettered as possible. Get rid of any regulations, privatize state-owned firms and other industries. Anything that might be considered a barrier to trade would be a kind of violation of the basic tenets of neoliberalism, and so on. And so that has really been the kind of guiding economic principles of the G8, but especially the United States and Britain. You know, that was sort of introduced with... Remember, people familiar maybe with Iron Lady, you know, the film about Margaret Thatcher, which kind of, she along with Ronald Reagan were the chief sort of driving force of neoliberalism in the early 1980s. And that's now been kind of generalized around the world. Now today, with the Eurozone, if people kind of have heard in the news, the sort of economic crisis, the financial crisis that has now produced a debt crisis. You know, what was initially a financial crisis led all the major industrialized countries, all the G8 countries, but especially the United States, France, Germany, to chip into bailing out the financial system, bailing out, you know, the biggest financial firms on the planet. That meant that they all took on a whole bunch of sovereign debt, you know, deficits increasing and so on. What does that mean then? It means they all now want to cut their budgets to solve the debt problem, which means cutting social services. It means cutting, going on the offensive against teachers and other public sector workers, cutting back on transit and so on. So that bailout of the world's biggest financial institutions is now being handed to the rest of us. We're the ones being forced to pay for it. And that's really what the G8, one of the things the G8 is very concerned about right now, because they're seeking to figure out how they can get out of this economic crisis that has produced stubbornly high unemployment and all sorts of other problems since 2008. So, but the other thing that the G8 does is defend the profits of their own domestic industries against competitors. That means against competitors in the developing world. It also means against competitors in the other G8 countries. So, I don't know, to borrow a phrase, they're a band of hostile brothers. Sometimes they can collaborate with one another. Sometimes they want to rip each other's throats out. So when it comes to fixing the debt crisis in the Eurozone, for example, France wants Germany to pay more to bail out, you know, some of the countries that are saddled with a lot of debt, like Greece. Germany wants France to pay more. Italy wants Germany and France to pay more. And the U.S. thinks that all of Europe should pay more, right? So they're all trying to figure out how to basically screw one another in the context of solving the crisis. But however hostile they are to one another's interests, they generally find ways to make common cause against the developing world and against working class and poor people in their own countries. In other words, the 99%. So take, for example, the issue of agricultural subsidies. In 2005, the United Nations Human Development Report said that the basic problem to be addressed in the World Trade Organization, the World Trade Organization being sort of one of the many institutions that the G8 uses to get its way. There's the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and then the G8, when they meet, they talk about how to use these various international institutions as levers to try to pursue what they think are their own interests. So the UN Human Development Report said, the basic problem to be addressed in World Trade Organization negotiations on agriculture can be summarized in three words: rich country subsidies. In other words, that the rich countries, the G8 countries, giving subsidies to their agricultural sector, to their big agribusinesses, meant that these are really efficient. Well, they're efficient because they're subsidized. They can turn out tons of product and make a profit off of it. But as a consequence, it undermines the less efficient agricultural sectors of the developing world. And so the UN then went on. This is, again, written in 2005. They said, in the last round of world trade negotiations, which were launched in Doha, Qatar, in 2001, rich countries promised to cut agricultural subsidies. But by 2005, between 2001 and 2005, those subsidies actually continued to grow. By 2005, the world's richest countries spent just over $1 billion on aid for agriculture in poor countries. That's $1 billion they spent over the course of the year of 2005. That same year, they were spending just under $1 billion each day to subsidize their own agribusinesses at home. So you can see how they are basically saying that they want to fix the problem of famine and food and agriculture in the developing world while they're basically subsidizing their own industries to 300 times the rate at which they're giving aid to the developing world. And that is what locks in that, you know, that inequality, that ranking of some of the more powerful nations at the top and the less so at the bottom. Some of the other things that that the G8 has done is, you know, just if people are familiar at all with the AIDS crisis, which is especially hard-hitting in Africa, the G8 has pursued, tried to stop the production of generic versions of AIDS drugs because they violate, quote, intellectual property rights. It's just another example. So that basically pricing these things out of reach of, you know, anyone but, you know, some of the richest people on the planet. Of course, they've also opposed climate change measures as barriers to trade and likewise targeted various laws that protect workers' rights and living standards and so on. So the annual G8 summit is a forum for the global elite to plan their use of these various institutions and to basically try to come up with some common plan to whatever extent that they can about how to manage the global economy and how it works. And what's kind of interesting is that today, some of those countries that have come under sort of the heel of the IMF, for example, the International Monetary Fund, are some of the countries of Europe that previously had been those powerful countries. That's the consequence of this debt crisis. So you see like Greece and Italy and so on now being forced to accept some of the same measures that have been pushed on the developing world over the course of years. Okay, so I want to say a couple last things and then open it up for discussion. First of all, I think the only way to understand the NATO and G8 summit happening here in May in Chicago is that it was a mistake. It shouldn't have happened this way. And let me say what I mean by that. Since 2001, when there were big protests against NATO and it was just the G8 then. It's almost unprecedented that NATO and G8 met at the same place. It hasn't happened since 1977, which is the only other time it happened, and that was in London. But in Genoa in 2001, there was a G8 meeting which led to 100,000 people in the streets, big protest. A protester was killed by police. His name was Carlo Giuliani. And that was right in the that came just a couple years after the battle in Seattle, if people remember the 1999 WTO protest there, and a kind of rising tide of global justice organizing and activism around the world, a lot of which was cut short and essentially disappeared in the wake of September 11th and the turn towards war by the United States and the war on terrorism and so on. I think that, and so ever since that year, 2001, all these G8 summits have been held in like out-of-the-way places that they could just put on lockdown where there would be no chance of protest or anything like that. Now, I think that it's likely that the planning, that the idea of holding the G8 and NATO together here in Chicago, in a big urban area known for a long history of social protest and so on, that probably was conceived of before the Egyptian Revolution, before the uprising of workers in Wisconsin this past spring, before, of course, the Occupy movement. So now, instead of having what they thought might be kind of a showpiece for Obama trying to reassert American influence in a world that was, you know, having an economic crisis and so on, and where they were, yeah, war in Iraq and Afghanistan weren't going that great, but at least, you know, they were flexing their muscles and so on. I think now you're looking at a situation where the sort of balance of forces in terms of what they could expect in terms of protest, but also the difficulty of holding together their various allies and so on, is just way more complicated, way more difficult than what they were really imagining. And this is, of course, coming right in the midst of the presidential election campaign. I mean, the sort of whiff of, if people have heard some of the references, you know, Democratic National Convention 1968, the way in which it, you know, torpedoed the Democratic Party's chances and so on and so forth. I mean, that happened here in Chicago, and there are certainly people that are anxious about that. That's, I think, going to be something that kind of just is in the background here as we talk about this issue and kind of prepare for this summit in the coming few months. I just want to say a couple last things as a conclusion, and I guess I'll leave some more of whatever, if we want to talk more about Kosovo, Afghanistan, Libya, NATO, or we'll let that kind of come from what people ask when we want to talk about. But I think the most important thing here is that, you know, NATO can't come out and say that their aim is to militarily encircle Russia and their other main competitor in the world down today, China. And they want to use, you know, NATO and ongoing, you know, build up militarily to do so. That does not sell well. You can't come out and say, we want to dominate the world. Won't you support us, right? You have to say that you're for peace and democracy and all those things. Just like with the G8, and the G8 can't come out and say, you know, we are trying to figure out how to impose austerity and, you know, how to cut social services and so on without encountering a big pushback from the Occupy movement, from labor unions and so on. They say we want global prosperity and equality for everyone, and we really are gonna address hunger and famine in Africa. We know we said we were going to drop our agricultural subsidies lower, but we raised them, and that was just, we don't know how that happened, you know, whatever the thing. So I guess the point here is that, you know, they never come out and say that. It's up to people like us to basically puncture those justifications, to start with rejecting them, to move from rejecting them to voicing our dissent, to beginning to organize and actually you know, make our opposition known, to the next step being to actually build a global movement that can go on the offensive, that can put muscle behind the demands of humanity, of the 99%, for a decent standard of living, for an environment that's not going to basically make life on this planet impossible to continue. Ahead of the needs of the 1%, we want to put, and ahead of the needs of the world's most powerful militaries and most powerful economies, you know, we want to have the you know, human need kind of be the driving force. And that's something we have to aspire to do in the here and now, but it's also a long-term project. And, you know, I guess I see that this summit coming here now offering us an opportunity to begin some of that organizing and work now that we know will take us a long time to accomplish, but is nevertheless, I think, a worthy project that we should aspire to. So thanks.
You've been hearing a presentation with Chicago analyst Eric Reuter, who spoke about NATO and G8 on January 21, 2012. To learn more about Chicago efforts against the NATO summit, go online to the website of the CanGate Coalition at cangate.wordpress.com. CanGate is spelled CANG and the numeral 8. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. To learn more and get involved in making media, including helping to make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Dale Lehman and Mitchell Stepinchik for audio assistance. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again with another episode From the Trenches.